Blog Talk Radio.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice, fair use, successful crowdfunding, how to ask for music rights, and what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com. Hi, and welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papan, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show. Our guest, Suzanne Mitchell, has produced numerous long and short-form television series and specials, as well as feature-length documentaries. She's won 2 Emmys, 2 Gracie Awards, and an Omni Intermedia Award. Her directorial debut of the feature film Running Wild, The Life of Dayton O'Hyde, garnered several more awards at film festivals, including the audience favorite at the Sarasota Film Festival. Running Wild opened nationwide in theaters on October 4th, this year, 2013, and Carol, Suzanne also won the Dean Grant for 2012, right?
Yes, we're so proud to be part of this film. Thank you so much, Suzanne, for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Claire. Thanks, Carol.
Well, we're going to start. There's so much we want to cover because you've done a magnificent job of finding a good story, developing it, staying with it for years, getting it distributed. And so here we go. Let's start. Go back into your history a bit, and after you started working in broadcast, I understand that you created the first news magazine show for Fox called The Reporters. So tell us how you found your flair for interviews.
I think it was, you know, everybody's got a story to tell, and I'm a listener, and I feel like people open up to me. I think the great Ov Weston, who created 2020, once told me I was the person who could get anyone to cry on camera. Now, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I know that I tap into people's emotions, and I'm able to get them to open up. And for some reason, they relate to me as an interviewer. So that always helps when you're putting together any type of news program, especially a magazine format, because you need people to be open and willing to talk about whatever it is that you're reporting on.
Right, and so you just found you had a flair for that.
I think I love to meet people and speak with them, regardless if there's a camera running or not. And, you know, with a camera running over your shoulder, just now you have something tangible that you can share with others. Well, I don't know if it's an innate instinct. It's just who I am.
It's an art, Suzanne. I've always said listening is an art because my father used to do it when he could have had any job in the company he wanted, but he wanted to wait on the counter to talk to the filmmakers. And when he would say, "Tell me about your film," we would all be in the background saying, "No, no," because that would be a 40-minute conversation, you know.
Aww.
And they might be buying 100 feet of 16 millimeter, but he didn't care. He was a good listener. And I think that is an art, so bravo. Now, you've been working with Academy Award winner Barbara Kopple, so tell us about some of those films.
Well, we worked on, way back in 1996, when I first worked with Barbara on a film called New Passages. That's the second time I got to go out west and meet my main character, who became the main character of my feature film, Dayton O'Hyde. And that was about, you know, Gail Sheehy's book, where we go through certain life changes, you know, different stages in everyone's life. We sort of, you know, in your 20s you're going to do this, in your 30s you're going to do this, 40s, 50s, 60s, and onwards. So that was the first project. And then we went on to do, a whole host of things. One of the most exciting projects was Woodstock now and then, and we put together a feature film to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Woodstock concert. And that was great because I personally got to interview a lot of those great musicians who were there in 1969, along with Michael Lang, who Barbara interviewed for the film, who created the concert, et cetera, et cetera. So that was another project we did together. We went to South Sudan to celebrate the life of a fantastic philanthropist named Ellen Ratner, who is on a political, she runs a political radio show called News Talk Radio. And she was traveling to the South Sudan with partners in radio and found that people who were enslaved in the north and were coming back south really needed to be integrated back in their homeland. And she was there to help. And then we decided that it was very much a part of her life, and we were doing a piece about Ellen that her brothers commissioned. And so we got to go to South Sudan together, which was quite amazing. And then it was an amazing experience. And then most recently, we are working now on a film about the 150th anniversary of that iconic progressive magazine called The Nation, which in 2015 will celebrate its 150th anniversary. And the folks from The Nation asked Barbara specifically if she would direct a film about this magazine, and we've been on the road filming with their reporters. And now that's in post-production.
But that must have been a lot of fun.
Oh, yes, amazing. Amazing. I mean, fun and moving.
And
you
moving.
Know, from Haiti. From,
you learned, I bet, were incredible stories.
From Haiti to people who were damaged not only economically but physically from the effects of the BP oil spill, to farmers who are losing everything, including ranchers and their cattle due to the excessive drought in the Texas Panhandle and New Mexico, to the recall vote on Governor Walker in the state of Wisconsin, to both the DNC and the RNC. I think, Carol, I was shooting at the RNC in Tampa, Florida, when you called me to tell me that I won the grant this year.
Wonderful. Well, that's a lot of traveling and a lot of fun and a lot of experience, Suzanne. Great. Now let's tell us, how did you find Dayton Hyde and Running Wild in that wonderful story?
Back in 1992, when I was working on a special for ABC, which was really to celebrate the the 20th anniversary of People magazine. Boy, I just realized I've celebrated a lot of anniversaries for magazines. Anyway, I was asked to look through 20 years of People, and it's a weekly, so that's a lot of magazines. And after, you know, the 1,500th celebrity divorce, I thought to myself, there has to be more to this and more exciting people out there than just what we read in the tabloids, even though People's not considered a tabloid. I'm just talking about the celebrity culture. And I decided to really start focusing on some of those ordinary people stories that they do in the magazine, and that's how I found the story of Dayton Hyde. It just jumped off the page because there were wild horses in the photograph, and I lobbied the executive producers to let me go out and do this as part of the special, and that's how I met him. That was back in 1992.
Wow. All right. And so let's bring us forward. You met him, you loved the idea, and then did you start looking for funding?
I didn't right away. I was still working in television, doing a lot of specials. You know, I went to Oprah Winfrey. I worked on her talk show in Chicago, came back to New York, met Barbara Koppel, started that project, New Passages, and then, again, told Barbara about this man that I had met in 92 that really struck a chord with me, and I felt we could do so much more with him than what I did on the People magazine special, and she said it would fit into the New Passages program, so I got to see him again. And so she always knew that I had this fondness for his story, but to tell it always as part of a bigger special, you know, really was truncating, you know, his whole life into, you know, either a 1.5 or 3.5 minute piece. So eventually high def came in, you know, and I felt, well, maybe I can actually afford to make this film on my own dime and then start it, at least start it, and then go out and try and get the rest of the funding. Barbara said to me at the time, it was 2001, it was just after the World Trade Center collapse, and she said, you know, if you don't start it, you'll never finish it.
That's right.
And that was 2001, and we picked up the cameras and we started, and then I tried, we all try to get financing. It's the most difficult part of a filmmaker's job.
Exactly. So, well, where did you find most of your money for this film? I usually find on documentaries that 70% of the money eventually comes from people.
Yes. Well, first it came from my house, my large mortgage that I still carry. Then it came from a couple of Chase credit cards and Bank of America credit cards. Thank you very much for giving me those low interest rates. And then eventually I said, well, wait a minute, I'm going to bankrupt my family, so we're going to have to find somebody to invest in. At the time, while I kept, you know, putting out the money myself, I kept going to folks like corporations, Ford Motor Corporation. There were Mustangs in this movie that sort of made sense to go to Ford Motor Corporation. I went to Ralph Lauren because it was about the great American West. I met with Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, and at the time they were promoting certain films in their stores, along with music as they do today. And still, I kept hitting a brick wall. Everybody loved the idea. They loved the small trailer that I had created from the footage that I had shot, but nobody wanted to fund the film. All of those corporations, and there were many more, said to me, come back when it's finished and we'll help you market it. And I said, but I can't get to that stage unless you give me the money to get it finished. So it was a catch-22. And so
right.
I put it down. I started getting really, sad by the fact that I couldn't sell it. But I also needed to get back to work and concentrate on making money to pay all these bills that were coming in that were associated to the film and just, you know, living life. So I put it down, and then Dayton, the Wild Horse Sanctuary that Dayton runs, and is the founder of, called and said, you know, Dayton's not getting any younger. Are you ever going to finish this? And you know what it's like to have a feel like you have the weight of the world on your shoulders. I always felt I had these amazing scenes, and they were sitting in a hermetically sealed box in my basement with a humidifier, you know, this HD cam tape. And I didn't want it to go just be wasted and never finish what I really dreamt and set out to complete. So that was late 2010, and I said, okay, well, I walked away from it for several years. Let me go back out there this year and start shooting again and see if I can get the whole film in the can, and then I'll worry about getting the post-production dollars. And so that's what I did, and at the same time, I started working with a distribution strategist, and we put together a really robust business plan for the film, which I hadn't had before. And then I was able to go out to investors to see if people would be interested in investing in what still is a very risky business.
Right.
That's where I met you, too, because my neighbor who lives across the street, who's a grant writer, not for films, but for other environmental for environmental projects, and this has an environmental thread that runs through it, and she said, you know, I found this grant, and that's where I found your grant, the Carol Dean grant. It was my neighbor who brought it to my attention.
Wasn't that sweet of her? It's the Roy Dean grant.
Dean, I'm sorry. Yes, of course, from Roy Dean.
Well, that was fantastic. Well, the minute I picked that up, I thought, oh, my gosh. The story was so powerful. Tell us about the story, because he found all these horses standing around in pens because people had stop the law that let them pick up the horses and kill them.
Exactly.
But the horses were stuck there, right?
They're stuck there. And, it's so funny because this topic has gotten so hot in the news. Just last night during prime time, Jane Velez Mitchell on Headline News for CNN did a whole report because there's a major roundup right now of wild Mustangs happening in Wyoming. Right now, they want to bring in 700 head of horses and put them in these feedlots, the same feedlots that Dayton saw 25 years ago filled with horses who were basically being held in jail, wild animals that were taken off the land, put into holding pens, and, you know, hoped to be adopted, but of course thousands of them are not adopted and they just sit there waiting. And it's a horrible story, and it continues today. Dayton had the foresight 25 years ago when this wasn't even on anybody's radar, and now it is. It's been covered by the New York Times. It's, you know, there's a lot of talk about what's happening in the West right now with the wild horses. But Dayton was so ahead of the curve in 1988 when he set out to create a 13,000-acre private wild horse sanctuary on good land, land that had proper feed, land that had proper water, land that these horses could live the rest of their lives out in freedom. And the first thing he had to do at 66 years old was fence it. He had to fence the entire property.
So,
he had a real vision, and he came up against a lot of cattle ranchers who, you know, live on the outskirts of the sanctuary or around the sanctuary who really didn't want him coming to town with these wild horses. They were fearful that the horses would escape and start eating all the grazing food for their own cattle, but that hasn't happened, and a lot of these people have come around since and realized that what he's doing is solving a problem for both sides of the issue.
Right. Well, how is he doing? Because the last time we talked, he was having trouble with the drought.
Yeah, and they had that big storm in he didn't get hit by it, but South Dakota got hit by a major blizzard. Literally on the day that we opened nationally in the theaters on October 4th, and Dayton was here in New York with his son for our premiere, and Susan Watt, his partner at the sanctuary, was dealing with no electricity and the snow. However, Dayton said, you know, in the area of the Black Hills where this, you know, the impact of the snow and also further north in South Dakota, people lost hundreds and thousands of head of cattle, thousands.
Wow.
And horses as well. There's a sanctuary run by a woman named Karen Sussman, and she unfortunately lost many of her Mustangs to the storm. But where Dayton's land is, and he says that he picked it out for not only for the reasons that it had great feed and great water, but it also is sheltered from the storms because elevation-wise where it sits, it's sort of low. And everything around it will get, you know, a foot of snow, and he'll get a couple of inches. Now, how that impacts the drought, you know, everything trickles downstream. So we're hoping that this year, you know, his riverbeds will be full and the aquifer will start to fill up and things will get better for hay production across the West, because even though it's 13,000 acres of grazing land, he still has to go out and purchase hay every winter. He has to purchase it to supplement, you know, the horses who only have, and it, you know, it sounds only, it's 13,000 acres, but that's only. They only have 13,000 acres that they can run on. And so he tries to mix up the pasture land so that the buffalo grass can regenerate. And when he's doing that, he has to throw out hay for the horses. And
right.
That costs a lot of money when there's a drought across the western United States.
Oh, yeah, because the hay price goes up too,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
How
it's
many horses does he have on the 13,000 acres?
Right now he has a little bit over 600. And, you know, he gets calls every day for taking in more horses, but they have to be really careful about how many head they put out there because they don't want the horses to suffer that they do have from overpopulation. So they have to be really careful with their numbers. You know, there's a prediction out west that most wild horses in the very near future will probably only be able to be seen on private lands because we're taking them off the public lands and handing the public lands over to the cattle ranching industry and the energy industry for fracking. The horse is sort of, you know, way down the list in terms of priorities for the public lands. So the cattlemen have a priority to get their horses out there, and the government, you know, allows this. There's a great lobby for the beef industry in Washington, as we know. And the energy industry lobbies to be able to drill for natural gas and oil on the public land. So the horses, you know, the lobby that they have is the general public. And while that general public is getting louder every day, there's a whole, you know, cross-section of us that don't even know that this problem exists out west. You know, we're trying to educate people right now, especially in the east, who had no idea that the wild horses were being threatened or that they're even being held in these feedlots at taxpayer dollars.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's quite a story.
That's a great story. Well, tell us now how your film was accepted in Slam Dance and what happened. Did you find that that was a good festival for you?
That was the best festival. Oh, it was the best festival because there you are in Park City, right? They call it the punk rock sister to Sundance because it's happening at the same time as Sundance, on the same street as Sundance, with the same distributors and the same buyers who are all scheduled around the clock to see films, and you have to be able to get their attention to come over to the Slam Dance screening facility. And, you know, we did a lot of work beforehand in terms of our public relations, reaching out to distributors and buyers so that they knew that our film would be there to try to get them to come see it, as well as the press. And it worked because we had several folks who saw it at Slam Dance who wanted to talk to us about distribution, and we wound up going with a company called Screen Media. And there were a lot of reasons for that. They were very much into the subject. The distributor herself was very moved by the film emotionally. That, to me, made a big difference because if you're going to sell my film, you better really like it yourself. Because I think that the best sales agents for anything in life are people that really believe in what it is that they're selling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, then, now, does she handle your DVD sales also?
So, yeah. So they have the right for the theatrical distribution, the DVD distribution, and the video on demand. And so what they decided to do was a day and date. So not only did we release in 19 cities on opening weekend, but they also released through video on demand and iTunes. And the DVD is now being released on December 3rd, and the contract is written in such a way that I can also sell DVDs through my own website, which we are doing. We're creating a store on the website. And that's really important to me because a portion of the sales of not only the DVD but the soundtrack that we published along with this movie and a signed book from Dayton Hyde, the subject of the movie, he's a prolific writer, an award-winning author, as well as a baseball cap that we created, will all be sold on my website, and a portion of the proceeds of those sales will go back to the Wild Horse Sanctuary. And we're not selling the DVD. We're keeping in the market price for the DVD as it would if you went to Amazon to buy it. But the only difference is with Amazon, you know, there's no buyback or there's no give back to the sanctuary. So I'm trying to drive people to my website to purchase the DVD. The website's runningwildfilm.com, because then we can give back to the sanctuary as well, besides covering our own costs.
That is great. Well, did Screen Media take the international distribution?
No, they have an international arm, and we're talking with them right now. And I'm still waiting to hear where we are with that. I was told to do a cut down of the film. It's 92 minutes, so I cut it down to 52 minutes, which you can imagine how difficult that was. I brought in a new editor for that with my original editor overseeing it because we wanted a whole new set of eyes on it.
Right.
Because, you know, you get married to what your cut is, and then to try and take that 40 minutes, we had to take 40 minutes out. I mean, it's huge. So we did it, and then we did that for a reason. We thought for the international market, they're really trying to sell television rights overseas, and so 52 minutes sounded right for TV, and we'll see what happens. So we have two versions that we're we're bringing around to the international distributors, and we'll see what happens. I don't have an answer right now.
And you, what about domestic television?
Well, they struck a deal with Netflix.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so as you know, Netflix is competing head-to-head these days with like HBO in terms of their subscription numbers. And so they offered the best deal, so we actually wound up going with Netflix.
Fantastic.
It's amazing, Carol, since I started this process, even with you, how much has changed. Every day,
this
whole digital landscape changes. I mean, it's incredible.
Well, and don't you think it's better for you?
It's better for everybody.
Good.
But I'll definitely let you know at the end of 2014 how good it is.
Because
it's still too early. You know, it's still too early to say. But you know, accessibility is fantastic, and that's certainly something that filmmakers didn't have in the past. The digital platform gives everybody accessibility to these types of films.
Yes, it does, and it's brilliant because there are these small markets around the United States, the people who love horses. They will love this. And those
we're
people
getting,
care about the environment, and so there are a lot of niche markets that will work really well with this. But tell me, did you have any tips that you want to share about theatrical distribution? What did you learn during that experience?
Well, you don't have to give it all away. You don't have to give it all away. You can retain some of the back end for yourself. In my case, we retained the right to find a foreign distributor. We didn't have to go with Screen Media's foreign arm. We retained the right to sell the DVDs and stream the film on my website, the filmmaker's website. So you don't have to give it all away. But you also look for a distributor who's willing to work with you also creatively. You know, I've been told, and I didn't realize, you know, this is my first feature film that I'm out there on my own with. You know, I'm not with Barbara Coppola on it. This is my baby. And so while I can learn a lot from my mentor, like Barbara, until you start to do it yourself, you don't really understand. So I kept saying, well, wait a minute, I want to see the poster. I want to see the art that they're creating for the film. You got to pass that by me. I want to see every – and Screen Media did. They consulted with me throughout. They had, like, five different options for the poster. Which one did I like? Then we talked about text. We talked about a lot of those things. And Peter Broderick, who's my distribution strategist, said, you know – you really got lucky because not all distributors do that. You know, they don't always involve you in that decision process of what will the poster look like. They kept me up to speed on what theaters we were opening in and what markets, and you know, let me weigh in on what I thought would work as well for the film because I had been in so many festivals and I knew the people that were relating to this film. So it's been great.
And I love Peter. I have to say that he is brilliant. And I remember when you submitted your proposal, that was the best distribution outline I had seen in years.
Yeah.
Well done.
I'm a quick study. Now I'm trying to learn semi-theatrical distribution. So that was the other part that we carved out with our agreement with Screen Media, that I can go ahead, you know, after the film has premiered, to start organizing semi-theatrical screenings. So, like, for instance, I just, even though it premiered in 2013, there's a festival called the Wild and Scenic Festival in Nevada, California, that is sponsored by Patagonia, and it's all about the environment and people like Dayton. You know, I mean, this film is the perfect film for that festival. And they contacted me recently when I was in Utah doing a semi-theatrical screening after we opened at the Salt Lake City Public Library during their book fair month. And this was a state-of-the-art library, by the way. I've never seen a library like this before. And we did a small concert with Steve Pulse, and then they showed the film, and we did NPR radio while we were in Utah. All of these things would not have been made possible if my distributor wasn't allowing me to go on the road with the film after we released theatrically. So, and we'll be at the Wild and Scenic Film Festival in January in California. And now we're starting to reach out to like-minded organizations who care about the issues in the West, the wild horses, the land, and want to show this film as part of an event, maybe to support their own organizations. And so that's sort of what the 2014 plan looks like.
Well, tell me about semi-theatrical screenings. Can you explain what that is?
It's basically one-off screenings where you're sending the film, most likely it'll be on a Blu-ray, to an organization that wants to screen it to an audience that will appreciate what the subject matter is. So, for instance, there is something in the United States every year called the Equine Affair. We will reach out to them for their 2014 event, which they have three of them. They have one in Massachusetts, one in Ohio, one in California. And they're big conferences where they have all the horse trainers there and people bring all sorts of horses and they have, you know, all the different booths selling all the horse accoutrements, blankets, bridles, et cetera, et cetera. And 98,000 people go to one of these shows.
Wow.
You know, 98,000 people visit the one in Massachusetts alone. So wouldn't it make sense if I could reach out to them and say, hey, we'd like to host a screening of the film, and we'll also, at the time, because our DVD will be out, we'll get a booth, you know, where all the sellers are, and we'll sell the DVD. So maybe I can combine a screening with the sale of a DVD. That's one model. Another model might be to go to one of the Wild Mustang foundations who are helping to save wild mustangs or get the word out, an educational group, and say, okay, you're located in northern Washington and you really care about this issue. Why don't you host a screening of the film? We'll make the film available, and then we can either split the proceeds from the fundraiser, or, you know, you could pay us outright, you know, $250 to screen the film. So it's a combination of things, and I'm still working it out. As a matter of fact, I had a conference call this morning with an organization called Film Sprout. This is what they do, and this is what they teach. And they're going to consult with myself, with me and my team, and we're going to figure out where we're going to take this film in 2014 through these semi-theatrical screenings. And it's not easy. It's complicated. I'm trying to learn it myself right now.
Okay, but the money is there enough. Would you have to go to every one of them?
No, you don't. You don't. And you couldn't, because it wouldn't economically make sense unless the organization was paying you to come and they felt like it was going to help draw people into the screening. So like in the case of Wild and Scenic, I'm going to go. In the case of Utah, they paid for all of our staying and for our flights and all of that, so that made sense to go. Moving forward, it's going to be a case-by-case scenario.
Okay, so when it is like a 250 flat fee or a split, then you take the money, but that's not enough to pay your airfare and hotel room to go.
Exactly.
Right?
Then I probably wouldn't go. Correct. Right. But you know what I'm doing? What I've been doing with Dayton on some of these, because we love it when he's able to participate, since he's the subject of the film. We've been bringing him in by Skype or Google chat. That's been fantastic.
In the theater,
yeah, and it works. A lot of people are set up now for this technology to have a computer attached to their projector and then through their sound system. So after the film screens, there's Dayton on the screen talking to the audience, and we're relaying the questions from the audience back to him, and he's answering directly to the people who are asking. So that works really well, and I certainly could do that as the filmmaker as well moving into the future.
That is brilliant. I love it, because when you cut out the transportation costs and the time it takes you to get from city to city, then you can really reach so many more people.
Right, right.
Well, now, the 2014 is finish this film, get it to as many people as possible, is what I heard you say.
Mm-hmm.
But have you found another film you want to do yet?
Everybody, I know, I was supposed to have this answer prepared last year when we premiered at Slam Dance, and I still don't have an answer. There's a lot of things that I'm looking at. I started to think about a transmedia project about my father, who was a jazz musician, and he's no longer, he passed away when I was 13, but I found all of these old 78 records that were crumbling and found the premier restorer of these 78 records in New York, and he's been written about in many, many newspapers and magazines as the go-to guy if you have to restore your 78 records. And he did it as one of the last jobs before he retired. So I started to think about how can I take this music, and it wasn't only music. He had done interviews on the Arthur Godfrey Show, et cetera, et cetera. He was a jazz pianist. And how can I take that music and turn it into a transmedia project? At the Tribeca Film Festival this year, there was something called the Transmedia Exhibit. And it's where you use multiple mediums to tell a single story. So to me, it was like, well, it started out on 78 records, and then we digitized them when we cleaned them up. Well, that's one part of the story, and that could be a short little film. But then what if we take one song from all of those records and we put it out through crowdsourcing, not crowdfunding, crowdsourcing, to find musicians all over the world that would want to reinterpret the music? And then what if they then submit their reinterpretations of the music and we find out, like, the top five, and we go visit them and we do short films about them?
Wow.
And then what about if after all of that is said and done, we actually take what they have created from that song that started out as my father's song and create a soundtrack? And how do we put all of that together in an exhibition? So instead of being a linear film that starts, you know, at 1 minute and takes you through to 92 minutes like mine does now, this would be sort of short bursts, but it would be using the internet. It would be using digital technology. It would be using filmmaking and audio recording as the different mediums to tell a story.
And that's only going to get broader and better.
Now tell me, Carol, how do I amortize that? Or monetize that, I should say.
How do you monetize
that? How do
it?
I monetize that, yeah.
Well, maybe
that's the part nobody's figured out yet.
Maybe it becomes a monthly donation. Maybe you set up a nonprofit, becomes a monthly donation of $5 a month that you get to hear all the music and all these things. But think of a payment thing like the cookbooks do nowadays.
That's a really good idea.
I think that's the way to do this, but let's get into the music rights. Would you have to pay music rights if it
No, because they were his original songs.
Oh, my God, you're in
heaven.
He
had a publishing company, which, of course, is defunct,
wow.
So it's perfect.
Oh, no, this is I would say this is a go, a green light sitting waiting for you.
We were in, my film was at the Prescott Film Festival in Prescott, Arizona, and I brought with me a friend who is a cinematographer, because my father, a jazz musician, right, grew up, was born in 1917 in Globe, Arizona. I had always wanted to see this one-horse town. It's still a one-horse town. And because we were in Prescott, we were only several hours away from Globe, I decided let's take a side trip for a couple of days after the festival, and I'm going to retrace his steps. So that's another thing that we put in the can at this point on film. Me literally meeting with the historical society person of the town, and she took me to the homes on record that my grandfather owned and the store that he managed. He was an insurance salesman in the town, so that we could get the beginning of my father's story on tape.
Right.
And so that's something, you know, it's all. And then Barbara Koppel did a sit-down interview with my mom because I felt it was better if someone else did it other than me.
Right.
And so she did about a three-hour interview with my mother. So we have that. You know, I've got little elements here and there sprinkled. I'd have to figure out how to put it together. I'm still trying to get my film out the door, though, with the DVD. So things have been crazy with Running Wild,
that.
You know.
But you have to have something in the future that you are sort of daydreaming about, because I think daydreaming is what really brings it into this dimension. You have to have
right.
a dream.
You're right.
Dan.
Well,
this would be a magnificent film. Great. And I will tell you that more and more grants are for transmedia projects.
Interesting. Yes, I found that out through the Knight Foundation, actually. It's about bringing community together. That's how they look at these things, at least some of the grantors. you know, how can you bring a community together?
And this would do it for jazz.
Yeah.
It'd be great fun for you. All right. Well, thank you so much. So let's just recap here, because your DVD sales open December the 4th.
December the 3rd. We're going to do pre-sales probably starting in the next couple of days. We're still getting the store up, and that should be finished by the end of this week, right after Thanksgiving. And then we'll put out a blast. We have, by the way, Carol, we have almost 83,000 likes on our Facebook page.
My gosh.
So we'll be blasting to them to let them know the DVDs are finally available, because people have been asking. And they'll be ready to be shipped starting December 3rd.
Okay. Well, then, Claire, we need to find out how people can reach Suzanne.
Yes, of course.
So go to the website. It's the easiest website, hopefully, to remember. Running Wild Film, that's singular, film.com, runningwildfilm.com. And then from there, you can figure out how to contact me. You can figure out how to buy the DVD. You can sign up for our e-news blast, where we'll let you know about the DVD going on sale. And you can see the trailer for the film and also see where it's going to be screening in the near future.
And where it's being screened. Okay. And anyone that would be interested in a semi-theatrical screening for their members should contact you. And so how would they contact you? Right on Running Wild?
Yeah. I mean, it's suzanne.mitchell@runningwildfilm.com. But if you just go to the contact page, it shoots an email into my inbox, and I respond.
Okay, Suzanne. All right. So we have to catch up with you next year and see what you've learned on the new semi-theatrical screenings, okay?
Yes, I'll have much better, more intelligent information by next year. This is just the beginning for me, so.
This is great. You're so kind. Thank you very much for joining us today and sharing all this important information.
Thank you so much, ladies. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Hey.
Oh, thanks. You too.
Okay,
all
bye.
All right, take good care of them. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklin is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklin.com. That's David, RAIKLEN.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at FromTheHeartProductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.